Side 8, Sphere, by Michael Crichton. Continuing on page 329. Oh, 600 hours. The only lights in the laboratory shone on the bench, next to a row of neatly buttoned envelopes, He touched the bottles absently. He turned on the laboratory monitor and punched buttons until he saw Beth downstairs on the video. Beth was working at the main D-Sil console. To one side, he saw Harry still lying unconscious. "Norman, can you hear me?" he said aloud. "Yes, Beth, I hear you." "Norman, you are acting irresponsibly. You are a menace to this entire expedition." Was that true? He wondered. He didn't think he was a menace to the expedition. It didn't feel true to him. But how often in his life had he confronted patients who refused to acknowledge what was happening in their lives? Even trivial examples. A man, another professor at the university, who was terrified of elevators, but who steadfastly insisted he always took the stairs because it was good exercise. The man would climb 15-story buildings. He would decline appointments in taller buildings. He arranged his entire life to accommodate a problem he would not admit he had. The problem remained concealed from him until he finally had a heart attack. Or the woman who was exhausted from years of caring for her disturbed daughter. She gave her daughter a bottle of sleeping pills because she said the girl needed a rest. The girl committed suicide. Or the novice sailor who cheerfully packed his family off on a sailing excursion to Catalina in a gale, nearly killing them all. Dozens of examples came to mind. It was a psychological truism, this blindness about self. Did he imagine that he was immune? 3 years ago, there had been a minor scandal when one of the assistant professors in the psychology department had committed suicide, sticking a gun in his mouth over the Labor Day weekend. There had been headlines for that one. Psych prof kills self. Colleagues express surprise, say deceased was always happy. The dean of the faculty, embarrassed in his fundraising, had berated Norman about that incident. But the difficult truth was that psychology had severe limitations. Even with professional knowledge and the best of intentions, there remained an enormous amount you never knew about your closest friends, your colleagues, your wives and husbands and children. And your ignorance about yourself was even greater than that. Self-awareness was the most difficult of all. Few people attained it. Or perhaps nobody attained it. "Norman, are you there?" "Yes, Beth." "I think you are a good person, Norman." He said nothing. He just watched at her on the monitor. "I think you have integrity, and that you believe in telling the truth. This is a difficult moment for you to face the reality about yourself. I know your mind is struggling now to find excuses to blame someone else. But I think you can do it, Norman. Harry couldn't do it, but you can. I think you can admit the hard truth, that so long as you remain conscious, the expedition is menaced." He felt the strength of her conviction, heard the quiet force of her voice. As Beth spoke, it felt almost as if her ideas were clothing being draped over his body. He began to see things her way. She was so calm, she must be right. Her ideas had such power. Her thoughts had such power. "Beth, have you been in the sphere?" "No, Norman. That's your mind trying to evade the point again. I haven't been in the sphere. You have." He honestly couldn't remember going into the sphere. He had no recollection at all. And when Harry had been in the sphere, he remembered afterward. Why would Norman forget? Why would he block it? "You're a psychologist, Norman," she was saying. "You, of all people, do not want to admit you have a shadow side. You have a professional stake in believing in your own mental health. Of course you will deny it." He didn't think so. But how to resolve it? How to determine if she was right or not? His mind wasn't working well. His cut knee throbbed painfully. At least there was no doubt about that. His injured knee was real. Reality testing. That was how to resolve it, he thought. Reality testing. What was the objective evidence that Norman had gone to the sphere? They had made tapes of everything that occurred in the habitat. If Norman had gone to the sphere many hours ago, somewhere there was a tape showing him in the airlock, alone, getting dressed, slipping away. Beth should be able to show him that tape. Where was that tape? In the submarine, of course. It would long ago have been taken to the submarine. Norman himself might have taken it when he made his excursion to the sub. No objective evidence. Norman, give up, please, for all our sakes. Perhaps she was right, he thought. She was so sure of herself. If he was evading the truth, if he was putting the expedition in jeopardy, then he had to give himself up and let her put him under. Could he trust her to do that? He would have to. There wasn't any choice. It must be me, he thought. It must be. The thought was so horrible to him. That in itself was suspicious. He was resisting it so violently. Not a good sign, he thought. Too much resistance. Norman? Okay, Beth. Will you do it? Don't push. Give me a minute, will you? Sure, Norman, of course. He looked at the video recorder next to the monitor. He remembered how Beth had used this recorder to play the same tape again and again, the tape in which the sphere had opened by itself. That tape was now lying on the counter beside the recorder. He pushed the tape into the slot, clicked the recorder on. Why bother to look at it now, he thought. You're just delaying. You're wasting time. The screen flickered, and he waited for the familiar image of Beth eating cake, her back to the monitor. But this was a different tape. This was a direct monitor feed showing the sphere. The gleaming sphere just sitting there. He watched for a few seconds, but nothing happened. The sphere was immobile, as always, polished, perfect, immobile. He watched a while longer, but there was nothing to see. Norman, if I open the hatch now, will you come down quietly? Yes, Beth. He sighed, sat back in the chair. How long would he be unconscious? A little less than 6 hours. It would be okay. But in any case, Beth was right. He had to give himself up. Norman, why are you watching that tape? He looked around quickly. Was there a video camera in the room allowing her to see him? Yes, high up in the ceiling, next to the upper hatch. Why are you watching that tape, Norman? It was here. Who said you could watch that tape? Nobody, Norman said. It was just here. Turn the tape off, Norman. Turn it off now. She didn't sound so calm anymore. What's the matter, Beth? Turn that damn tape off, Norman! He was about to ask her why, but then he saw Beth enter the video image, stand next to the sphere. Beth closed her eyes and clenched her fists. The convoluted grooves of the sphere parted, revealing blackness. And as he watched, Beth stepped inside the sphere, and the door of the sphere closed behind her. "You goddamned men," Beth said in a tight, angry voice. "You're all the same. You can't leave well enough alone, none of you." "You lied to me, Beth." "Why did you watch that tape? I begged you not to watch that tape." "It could only hurt you to watch that tape, Norman." She wasn't angry anymore. Now she was pleading, near tears. She was undergoing rapid emotional shifts, unstable, unpredictable. And she was in control of the habitat. "Beth."
"I'm sorry, Norman. I can't trust you anymore."
"Beth."
"I'm turning you off, Norman. I'm not going to listen to..."
"Beth, wait.
You anymore. I know how dangerous you are. I saw what you did to Harry. How you twisted the facts so that it was Harry's fault."
"Oh, yes, it was Harry's fault by the time you got through. And now you want to make it Beth's fault, don't you?"
"Well, let me tell you, Norman, you won't be able to do it because I have shut you off, Norman.
I can't hear your soft, convincing words. I can't hear your manipulation.
so don't waste your breath, Norman."
He stopped the tape. The monitor now showed Beth at the console in the room below, pushing buttons on the console. "Beth," he said. She didn't reply. She just went on working at the console, muttering to herself, "You're a real son of a bitch, Norman. You know that? You feel so terrible that you need to make everybody else just as low as you are." She was talking about herself, he thought. "You're so big on the unconscious, Norman. The unconscious this, the unconscious that. Jesus Christ, I'm sick of you. Your unconscious probably wants to kill us all just because you want to kill yourself and you think everybody else should die with you." He felt a shuddering chill. Beth, with her lack of self-esteem, her deep core of self-hate, had gone inside the sphere. And now she was acting with the power of the sphere, but without stability to her thoughts. Beth saw herself as a victim who struggled against her fate, always unsuccessfully. Beth was victimized by men, victimized by the establishment, victimized by research, victimized by reality. In every case, she failed to see how she had done it to herself. "And she's put explosives all around the habitat," he thought. "I won't let you do it, Norman. I'm going to stop you before you kill us all." Everything she said was the reverse of the truth. He began to see the pattern now. Beth had figured out how to open the sphere, and she had gone there in secret, because she had always been attracted to power. She always felt she lacked power and needed more. But Beth wasn't prepared to handle power once she had it. Beth still saw herself as a victim, so she had to deny the power and arrange to be victimized by it. It was very different from Harry. Harry had denied his fears, and so fearful images had manifested themselves. But Beth denied her power, and so she manifested a churning cloud of formless, uncontrolled power. Harry was a mathematician who lived in a conscious world of abstraction, of equations and thoughts. A concrete form like a squid was what Harry feared. But Beth, the zoologist who dealt every day with animals, creatures she could touch and see, created an abstraction, a power that she could not touch or see. A formless, abstract power that was coming to get her. And to defend herself, she had armed the habitat with explosives. It wasn't much of a defense, Norman thought, unless you secretly wanted to kill yourself. The horror of his true predicament became clear to him. "You won't get away with this, Norman. I won't let it happen. Not to me." She was punching keys on the console. What was she planning? What could she do to him? He had to think. Suddenly, the lights in the laboratory went off. A moment later, the big space heater died, the red elements cooling, turning dark. She had shut off the power. With the heater turned off, how long could he last? He took the blankets from her bed, wrapped himself in them. How long without heat? Certainly not 6 hours, he thought grimly. "I'm sorry, Norman, but you understand the position I'm in. As long as you're conscious, I'm in danger." "Maybe an hour," he thought. "Maybe I can last an hour." "I'm sorry, Norman, but I have to do this to you." He heard a soft hiss. The alarm on his chest badge began to beep. He looked down at it. Even in the darkness, he could see it was now gray. He knew immediately what had happened. Beth had turned off his air. 0535 hours. Huddled in the darkness, listening to the beep of his alarm and the hiss of the escaping air, the pressure diminishing rapidly, his ears popped as if he were in an airplane taking off. "Do something," he thought, feeling a surge of panic. But there was nothing he could do. He was locked in the upper chamber of D-Sill. He could not get out. Beth had control of the entire facility, and she knew how to run the life support systems. She had shut off his power, she had shut off his heat, and now she had shut off his air. He was trapped. As the pressure fell, the sealed specimen bottles exploded like bombs, shooting fragments of glass across the room. He ducked under the blankets, feeling the glass rip and tug at the cloth. Breathing was harder now. At first he thought it was tension, and then he realized that the air was thinner. He would lose consciousness soon. Do something. He couldn't seem to catch his breath. Do something! But all he could think about was breathing.
He needed air, needed oxygen. Then he thought of the first aid cabinet. Wasn't there emergency oxygen in the cabinet? He wasn't sure. He seemed to remember. As he got up, another specimen bottle exploded, and he twisted away from the flying glass. He was gasping for breath, chest heaving. He started to see gray spots before his eyes. He fumbled in the darkness, looking for the cabinet, his hands moving along the wall. He touched a cylinder. Oxygen? No, too large. It must be the fire extinguisher. Where was the cabinet? His hands moved along the wall. Where? He felt the metal case, the embossed cover with the raised cross. He pulled it open, thrust his hands inside. More spots swam before his eyes. There wasn't much time. His fingers touched small bottles, soft bandage packs. There was no air bottle. Damn. The bottles fell to the floor. And then something large and heavy landed on his foot with a thud. He bent down, touched the floor, felt a shard of glass cut his finger, paid no attention. His hand closed over a cold metal cylinder. It was small, hardly longer than the palm of his hand. At one end was some fitting, a nozzle. It was a spray can. Some kind of damn spray can. He threw it aside. Oxygen. He needed oxygen. By the bed, he remembered. Wasn't there emergency oxygen by every bed in the habitat? He felt for the couch where Beth had slept, felt for the wall above where her head would have been. Surely there was oxygen nearby. He was dizzy now. He wasn't thinking clearly. No oxygen. Then he realized this wasn't a regular bed. It wasn't intended for sleeping. They wouldn't have placed any oxygen here. Damn! And then his hand touched a metal cylinder, clipped to the wall. At one end was something soft. Soft. An oxygen mask. Quickly, he pushed the mask over his mouth and nose. He felt the bottle, twisted a knurled knob. He heard a hissing, breathed cold air. He felt a wave of intense dizziness, and then his head cleared. Oxygen! He was fine! He felt the shape of the bottle, gauging its size. It was an emergency bottle, only a few hundred cc's. How long would it last? Not long, he thought. A few minutes. It was only a temporary reprieve. Do something. But he couldn't think of anything to do. He had no options. He was locked in a room. He remembered one of his teachers, fat old Dr. Temkin. You always have an option. There is always something you can do. You are never without choice. I am now, he thought. No choices now. Anyway, Temkin had been talking about treating patients, not escaping from sealed chambers. Temkin didn't have any experience escaping from sealed chambers, and neither did Norman. The oxygen made him lightheaded, or was it already running out? He saw a parade of his old teachers before him. Was this like seeing your life running before you, before you died? All his teachers. Mrs. Jefferson, who told him to be a lawyer instead. Old Joe Lamper, who laughed and said, "Everything is sex. Trust me, it always comes down to sex." Dr. Stein, who used to say, "There is no such thing as a resistant patient. Show me a resistant patient, and I'll show you a resistant therapist. If you're not making headway with a patient, then do something else. Do anything else, but do something. Do something." Stein advocated crazy stuff. If you weren't getting through to a patient, get crazy. Dress up in a clown suit. Kicked the patient, squirt him with a water pistol, do any damn thing that came into your head, but do something. Look, he used to say, what you're doing now isn't working, so you might as well do something else, no matter how crazy it seems. That was fine back then, Norman thought. He'd like to see Stein assess this problem. What would Dr. Stein tell him to do? Open the door. I can't, she's locked it. Talk to her. I can't, she won't listen. Turn on your air. I can't, she has control of the system. Get control of the system. I can't. She is in control. Find help inside the room. I can't. There is nothing left to help me. Then leave. I can't. He paused. That wasn't true. He could leave by smashing a porthole, or for that matter, by opening the hatch in the ceiling. But there was no place to go. He didn't have a suit. The water was freezing. He had been exposed to that freezing water for only a few seconds, and he had nearly died. If he were to leave the room for the open ocean, he would almost surely die. He'd probably be fatally chilled before the chamber even filled with water. He would surely die.
In his mind, he saw Stein raise his bushy eyebrows, give his quizzical smile.
So, you'll die anyway. What have you got to lose?
A plan began to form in Norman's mind. If he opened the ceiling hatch, he could go outside the habitat. Once outside, perhaps he could make his way down to A-Sil, get back in through the airlock, and put his suit on. Then he would be okay.
If he could make it to the airlock. How long would that take?
30 seconds?
A minute?
Could he hold his breath that long? Could he withstand the cold that long? You'll die anyway. And then he thought, you damn fool, you're holding an oxygen bottle in your hand. You have enough air if you don't stay here wasting time worrying. Get on with it.
No, he thought, there's something else, something I'm forgetting.
Get on with it. So he stopped thinking and climbed up to the ceiling hatch at the top of the cylinder. Then he held his breath, braced himself, and spun the wheel, opening the hatch.
Norman! Norman, what are you doing? Norman! You are insane!
He heard Beth shout, and then the rest was lost in the roar of freezing water pouring like a mighty waterfall into the habitat, filling the room. The moment he was outside, he realized his mistake. He needed weights. His body was buoyant, tugging him up toward the surface. He sucked a final breath, dropped the oxygen bottle, and desperately gripped the cold pipes on the outside of the habitat, knowing that if he lost his grip, there would be nothing to stop him, nothing to grab onto all the way to the surface. He would reach the surface and explode like a balloon. Holding the pipes, he pulled himself down, hand over hand, looking for the next pipe, the next protrusion to grab. It was like mountain climbing in reverse. If he let go, he would fall upward and die. His hands were long since numb. His body was stiff with cold, slow with cold. His lungs burned. He had very little time. He reached the bottom, swung under D-sill, pulled himself along, felt in the darkness for the airlock. It wasn't there. The airlock was gone. Then he saw he was beneath B-sill. He moved over to A, felt the airlock. The airlock was closed. He tugged the wheel. It was shut tight. He pulled on it, but he could not move it. He was locked out. The most intense fear gripped him. His body was almost immobile from cold. He knew he had only a few seconds of consciousness remaining. He had to open the hatch. He pounded it, pounded the metal around the rim, feeling nothing in his numb hands. The wheel began to spin by itself. The hatch popped open. There must have been an emergency button. He burst above the surface of the water, gasped air, and sank again. He came back up, but he couldn't climb out into the cylinder. He was too numb, his muscles frozen, his body unresponsive. You have to do it, he thought. You have to do it. His fingers gripped metal, slipped off, gripped again. One pull, he thought. One last pull. He heaved his chest over the metal rim, flopped onto the deck. He couldn't feel anything, he was so cold. He twisted his body, trying to pull his legs up, and fell back into the icy water. No! He pulled himself up again, one last time, again over the rim, again onto the deck, and he twisted one leg up, his balance precarious. Then the other leg, he couldn't really feel it. And then he was out of the water and lying on the deck. He was shivering. He tried to stand and fell over. His whole body was shaking so hard he could not keep his balance. Across the airlock he saw his suit hanging on the wall of the cylinder. He saw the helmet, Johnson, stenciled on it. Norman crawled toward the suit, his body shaking violently. He tried to stand and could not. The boots of his suit were directly in front of his face. He tried to grip them in his hands, but his hands could not close. He tried to bite the suit, to pull himself up with his teeth, but his teeth were chattering uncontrollably. The intercom crackled. Norman! I know what you're doing, Norman! Any minute Beth would be here. He had to get into the suit. He stared at it, inches from him, but his hands still shook. He could not hold anything. Finally, he saw the fabric loops near the waist to clip instruments. He hooked one hand into the loop, managed to hold on. He pulled himself upright. He got one foot into the suit, then the other.
Norman!
He reached for the helmet. The helmet drummed in a staccato beat against the wall before he managed to get it free of the peg and drop it over his head. He twisted it, heard the click of the snap lock. He was still very cold.
Why wasn't the suit heating up?
Then he realized no power.
The power was in the tank pack. Norman backed up against the tank, shrugged it on, staggered under the weight. He had to hook the umbilicus. He reached behind him, felt it, held it, hook it into the suit, at the waist, hook it.
He heard a click. The fan hummed.
He felt long streaks of pain all over his body. The electrical elements were heating, painful against his frozen skin. He felt pins and needles all over. Beth was talking. He heard her through the intercom, but he couldn't listen to her. He sat heavily on the deck, breathing hard. But already he knew that he was going to be all right. The pain was lessening, his head was clearing, and he was no longer shaking so badly. He had been chilled, but not long enough for it to be central. He was recovering fast. The radio crackled. "You'll never get to me, Norman." He got to his feet, pulled on his weight belt, locked the buckles. "Norman!" He said nothing. He felt quite warm now, quite normal. "Norman! I am surrounded by explosives. If you come anywhere near me, I will blow you to pieces. You'll die, Norman. You'll never get near me."
But Norman wasn't going to Beth. He had another plan entirely. He heard his tank air hiss as the pressure equalized in his suit. He jumped back into the water.
0500 hours. The sphere gleamed in the light. Norman saw himself reflected in its perfectly polished surface, then saw his image break up, fragmented on the convolutions, as he moved around to the back, to the door. It looked like a mouth, he thought, like the maw of some primitive creature about to eat him. Confronted by the sphere, seeing once again the alien, unhuman pattern of the convolutions, he felt his intention dissolve. He was suddenly afraid. He didn't think he could go through with it. "Don't be silly," he told himself. "Harry did it, and Beth did it. They survived." He examined the convolutions as if for reassurance, but there wasn't any reassurance to be obtained. Just curved grooves in the metal, reflecting back the light. "Okay," he thought finally. "I'll do it. I've come this far. I've survived everything so far. I might as well do it. Go ahead and open up." But the sphere did not open. It remained exactly as it was, a gleaming, polished, perfect shape. What was the purpose of the thing? He wished he understood its purpose. He thought of Dr. Stein again. What was Stein's favorite line? "Understanding is a delaying tactic." Stein used to get angry about that. When the graduate students would intellectualize, going on and on about patients and their problems, he would interrupt in annoyance, "Who cares? Who cares whether we understand the psychodynamics in this case? Do you want to understand how to swim? Or do you want to jump in and start swimming? Only people who are afraid of the water want to understand it. Other people jump in and get wet." "Okay," Norman thought, "let's get wet." He turned to face the sphere and thought, "Open up." The sphere did not open. "Open up," he said aloud. The sphere did not open. Of course, he knew that wouldn't work because Ted had tried it for hours. When Harry and Beth went in, they hadn't said anything. They just did something in their minds. He closed his eyes, focused his attention, and thought, "Open up." He opened his eyes and looked at the sphere. It was still closed. "I am ready for you to open up," he thought. "I am ready now." Nothing happened. The sphere did not open. Norman hadn't considered the possibility that he would be unable to open the sphere. After all, two others had already done it. How had they managed it? Harry, with his logical brain, had been the first to figure it out. But Harry had only figured it out after he had seen Beth's tape. So Harry had discovered a clue in the tape, an important clue. Beth had also reviewed the tape, watching it again and again, until she finally figured it out, too. Something in the tape. Too bad he didn't have the tape here, Norman thought. But he had seen it often. He could probably reconstruct it, play it back in his mind. How did it go? In his mind, he saw the images,
Beth and Tina talking, Beth eating cake. Then Tina had said something about the tapes being stored in the submarine, and Beth said something back. Then Tina had moved away, out of the picture, but she had said, "Do you think they'll ever get the sphere open?" And Beth said, "Maybe. I don't know." And the sphere had opened at that moment. Why? "Do you think they'll ever get the sphere open?" Tina had asked. And in response to such a question, Beth must have imagined the sphere open, must have seen an image of the open sphere in her mind. There was a deep, low rumble, a vibration that filled the room. The sphere was open, the door gaping wide and black. That's it, he thought. Visualize it happening, and it happens. Which meant that if he also visualized the sphere door closed, with another deep rumble, the sphere closed. Or open, the sphere opened again. "I'd better not press my luck," he said aloud. The door was still open. He peered in the doorway, but saw only deep, undifferentiated blackness. "It's now or never," he thought. He stepped inside. The sphere closed behind him. There is darkness. And then, as his eyes adjust, something like fire flies. It is a dancing, luminous foam, millions of points of light swirling around him. "What is this?" he thinks. All he sees is the foam. There is no structure to it, and apparently no limit. It is a surging ocean, a glistening, multifaceted foam. He feels great beauty and peace. It is restful to be here. He moves his hands, scooping the foam, his movements making it swirl. But then he notices that his hands are becoming transparent, that he can see the sparkling foam through his own flesh. He looks down at his body. His legs, his torso, everything is becoming transparent to the foam. He is part of the foam. The sensation is very pleasant. He grows lighter. Soon he is lifted and floats in the limitless ocean foam. He puts his hands behind his neck and floats. He feels happy. He feels he could stay here forever. He becomes aware of something else in this ocean, some other presence. "Anybody here?" he says. "I am here." He almost jumps, it is so loud, or it seems loud. Then he wonders if he has heard anything at all. "Did you speak?" "No." "How are we communicating?" he wonders. "The way everything communicates with everything else." "Which way is that?" "Why do you ask if you already know the answer?" "But I don't know the answer." The phone moves him gently, peacefully, but he receives no answer for a time. He wonders if he is alone again. "Are you there?" "Yes." "I thought you had gone away." "There is nowhere to go." "Do you mean you are imprisoned inside this sphere?"
"No."
"Will you answer a question? Who are you?"
"I am not a who."
"Are you God?"
"God is a word."
"I mean, are you a higher being or a higher consciousness?"
"Higher than what?"
"Higher than me, I suppose."
"How high are you?"
"Pretty low, at least I imagine so."
"Well then, that's your trouble." Riding in the foam, he is disturbed by the possibility that God is making fun of him. He thinks, "Are you making a joke?" "Why do you ask if you already know the answer?"
"Am I talking to God?"
"You are not talking at all."
"You take what I say very literally. Is this because you are from another planet?"
"No."
"Are you from another planet?"
"No."
"Are you from another civilization?"
"No."
Where are you from?
Why do you ask if you already know the answer? In another time, he thinks, he would be irritated by this repetitive answer. But now he feels no emotions. There are no judgments. He is simply receiving information, a response. He thinks, but this fear comes from another civilization.
Yes.
And maybe from another time.
Yes.
And aren't you a part of this sphere?
I am now.
So, where are you from?
Why do you ask if you already know the answer?
The foam gently shifts him, rocking him soothingly.
Are you still there?
Yes, there is nowhere to go. I am afraid I am not very knowledgeable about religion. I am a psychologist. I deal with how people think. In my training, I never learned much about religion.
Oh, I see.
Psychology doesn't have much to do with religion.
Of course.
So you agree?
I agree with you.
That's reassuring.
I don't see why.
Who is I?
Who indeed?
He rocks in the foam, feeling a deep peace despite the difficulties of this conversation.
I am troubled, he thinks.
Tell me. I am troubled because you sound like Jerry.
That is to be expected.
But Jerry was really Harry.
Yes.
So you are Harry, too?
No, of course not.
Who are you?
I am not a who.
Then why do you sound like Jerry or Harry?
Because we spring from the same source. I don't understand. When you look in the mirror, who do you see?
I see myself.
I see.
Isn't that right?
It's up to you.
I don't understand.
What you see is up to you.
I already know that. Everybody knows that. That is a psychological truism, a cliché.
I see.
Are you an alien intelligence?
Are you an alien intelligence? I find you difficult to talk to. Will you give me the power? What power?
The power you gave to Harry and Beth. The power to make things happen by imagination. Will you give it to me?
No.
Why not?
Because you already have it.
I don't feel as if I have it.
I know.
Then how is it that I have the power?
How did you get in here? I imagined the door opening. Yes.
Rocking in the foam, waiting for a further response.
But there is no response. There is only gentle movement in the foam. A peaceful timelessness and a drowsy sensation. After a passage of time, he thinks,
I am sorry, but I wish you would just explain and stop speaking in riddles.
On your planet, you have an animal called a bear. It is a large animal, sometimes larger than you, and it is clever and has ingenuity, and it has a brain as large as yours. But the bear differs from you in one important way. It cannot perform the activity you call imagining. It cannot make mental images of how reality might be. It cannot envision what you call the past and what you call the future.
This special ability of imagination is what has made your species as great as it is.
Nothing else. It is not your ape nature, not your tool-using nature, not language, or your violence, or your caring for young, or your social groupings. It is none of these things, which are all found in other animals. Your greatness lies in imagination. The ability to imagine is the largest part of what you call intelligence. You think the ability to imagine is merely a useful step on the way to solving a problem or making something happen. But imagining it is what makes it happen. This is the gift of your species, and this is the danger, because you do not choose to control your imaginings. You imagine wonderful things, and you imagine terrible things, and you take no responsibility for the choice. You say you have inside you both the power of good and the power of evil, the angel and the devil. But in truth, you have just one thing inside you, the ability to imagine. I hope you enjoyed this speech, which I plan to give at the next meeting of the American Association of Psychologists and Social Workers, which is meeting in Houston in March. I feel it will be quite well received. What? He thinks, startled. Who did you think you were talking to? God? Who is this? He thinks. You, of course. But you are somebody different from me, separate. You are not me, he thinks. Yes, I am. You imagined me. Tell me more. There is no more. His cheek rested on cold metal. He rolled onto his back and looked at the polished surface of the sphere curving above him. The convolutions of the door had changed again. Norman got to his feet. He felt relaxed and at peace, as if he had been sleeping a long time. He felt as if he had had a wonderful dream. He remembered everything quite clearly. He moved through the ship, back to the flight deck, and then down the hallway with the ultraviolet lights to the room with all the tubes on the wall. The tubes were filled. There was a crewman in each one. Just as he thought, Beth had manifested a single crewman, a solitary woman, as a way of warning them. Now Norman was in charge, and he found the room full. Not bad, he thought. He looked at the room and thought, gone, one at a time. One by one, the crew members in the tubes vanished before his eyes, until they were all gone. Back, one at a time. The crew members popped back in the tubes, materializing on demand. All men. The women were changed into men. All women. They all became women. He had the power. Oh, 200 hours. Norman! Beth's voice over the loudspeakers, hissing through the empty spacecraft. Where are you, Norman? I know you're there somewhere. I can feel you, Norman. Norman was moving through the kitchen, past the empty cans of Coke on the counter, then through the heavy door, and into the flight deck. He saw Beth's face on all the console screens, Beth seeming to see him, the image repeated a dozen times. Norman, I know where you've been. You've been inside the sphere, haven't you, Norman? He pressed the consoles with the flat of his hand, trying to turn off the screens. He couldn't do it. The images remained. Norman! Answer me, Norman! He moved past the flight deck, going toward the airlock. It won't do you any good, Norman. I'm in charge now. Do you hear me, Norman? In the airlock, he heard a click as his helmet ring locked. The air from the tanks was cool and dry. He listened to the even sound of his own breathing. Norman! Beth on the intercom in his helmet. Why don't you speak to me, Norman? Are you afraid, Norman? The repetition of his name irritated him. He pressed the buttons to open the airlock. Water began to flood in from the floor, rising swiftly. "Oh, there you are, Norman. I see you now."
And she began to laugh, a high cackling laugh. Norman turned around, saw the video camera mounted on the robot still inside the airlock. He shoved the camera, spinning it away.
"That won't do any good, Norman."
He was back outside the spacecraft, standing by the airlock. The TVAC explosives, rows of glowing red dots, extended away in erratic lines, like an airplane runway laid out by some demented engineer.
"Norman? Why don't you answer me, Norman?"
Beth was unstable, erratic. He could hear it in her voice. He had to deprive her of her weapons, to turn off the explosives if he could. "Off," he thought. "Let's have the explosives off and disarmed." All the red lights immediately went off. "Not bad," he thought, with a burst of pleasure. A moment later, the red lights blinked back on.
"You can't do it, Norman," Beth said, laughing. "Not to me. I can fight you."
He knew she was right. They were having an argument, a test of wills, turning the explosives on and off. And the argument couldn't ever be resolved, not that way. He would have to do something more direct. He moved toward the nearest of the TVAC explosives. Up close, the cone was larger than he had thought, 4 feet high, with a red light at the top.
"I can see you, Norman. I see what you're doing."
There was writing on the cone, yellow letters stenciled on the gray surface. Norman bent to read it. His faceplate was slightly fogged, but he could still make out the words. "Danger, TVAC explosives. USN construction demolition use only. Default detonate sequence 2000. Consult manual USN VV-512A. Authorized personnel only. Danger, TVAC explosives." There was still more writing beneath that, but it was smaller, and he couldn't make it out.
"Norman! What are you doing with my explosives, Norman?"
Norman didn't answer her. He looked at the wiring. One thin cable ran into the base of the cone, and a second cable ran out. The second cable went along the muddy bottom to the next cone, where there were again just two cables, one in and one out.
"Get away from there, Norman. You're making me nervous."
One cable in and one cable out. Beth had wired the cones together in series, like Christmas tree bulbs. By pulling out a single cable, Norman would disconnect the entire line of explosives. He reached forward and gripped the cable in his gloved hand.
"Norman! Don't touch that wire, Norman!"
"Take it easy, Beth." His fingers closed around the cable. He felt the soft plastic coating, gripped it tightly.
"Norman, if you pull that cable, you'll set off the explosives. I swear to you. It'll blow you and me and Harry and everything to hell, Norman!"
He didn't think it was true. Beth was lying. Beth was out of control, and she was dangerous, and she was lying to him again. He drew his hand back. He felt the tension in the cable.
"Don't do it, Norman!"
The cable was now taut in his hand. "I'm going to shut you down, Beth."
"For God's sake, Norman, believe me, will you? You'll kill us all!"
Still he hesitated. Could she be telling the truth?
Did she know about wiring explosives?
He looked at the big gray cone at his feet, reaching up to his waist. What would it feel like if it exploded? Would he feel anything at all? "The hell with it," he said aloud. He pulled the cable out of the cone. The shriek of the alarm, ringing inside his helmet, made him jump. There was a small liquid crystal display at the top of his faceplate, blinking rapidly. "Emergency! Emergency!"
"Oh, Norman! God damn it! Now you've done it!"
He barely heard her voice over the alarm. The red cone lights were blinking all down the length of the spacecraft. He braced himself for the explosion. But then, the alarm was interrupted by a deep, resonant male voice that said, "Your attention, please. Your attention, please. All construction personnel clear the blast area immediately. TVAC explosives are now activated. The countdown will begin now. Mark 20 and counting." On the cone, a red display flashed 2000. Then it began counting backward. 1959, 1958. The same display was repeated on the crystal display at the top of his helmet. It took him a moment to put it together, to understand. Staring at the cone, he read the yellow lettering once again. USN, construction, demolition, use only. Of course, TVAC explosives weren't weapons. They were made for construction and demolition. They had built-in safety timers, a programmed 20-minute delay before they went off, to allow workers to get away. 20 minutes to get away, he thought. That would give him plenty of time. Norman turned and began striding quickly toward DH-7 and the submarine. 0140 hours. He walked evenly, steadily. He felt no strain. His breath came easily. He was comfortable in his suit, all systems working smoothly. He was leaving. Norman, please! Now Beth was pleading with him, another erratic shift of mood. Norman ignored her. He continued on toward the submarine. The deep, recorded voice said, "Your attention, please. All Navy personnel clear the blast area. 19 minutes and counting." Norman felt an enormous sense of purposefulness, of power. He had no illusions anymore. He had no questions. He knew what he had to do. He had to save himself.
"I don't believe you're doing this, Norman. I don't believe you're abandoning us."
Believe it, he thought. After all, what choice did he have? Beth was out of control and dangerous. It was too late to save her now. In fact, it was crazy to go anywhere near her. Beth was homicidal. She'd already tried to kill him once and had nearly succeeded. And Harry had been drugged for 13 hours. By now he was probably clinically dead, brain dead. There was no reason for Norman to stay. There was nothing for him to do. The sub was close now. He could see the fittings on the yellow exterior.
"Norman, please. I need you."
"Sorry," he thought. "I'm getting out of here." He moved around beneath the twin propeller screws, the name painted on the curved hull, Deep Star 3. He climbed the footholds, moving up into the dome.
"Norman!"
Now he was out of contact with the intercom. He was on his own. He opened the hatch, climbed inside the submarine. He unlocked his helmet, pulled it off. "Your attention, please. 18 minutes and counting." Norman sat in the pilot's padded seat, faced the controls. The instruments blinked on, and the screen, directly before him, glowed. "Deep Star 3, command module. Do you require help? Yes, no, cancel." He pressed yes. He waited for the next screen to flash up. It was too bad about Harry and Beth. He was sorry to leave them behind, but they had both, in their own ways, failed to explore their inner selves, thus making them vulnerable to the sphere and its power. It was a classic scientific error, this so-called triumph of rational thought over irrational thought. Scientists refused to acknowledge their irrational side, refused to see it as important. They dealt only with the rational. Everything made sense to a scientist, and if it didn't make sense, it was dismissed as what Einstein called the merely personal. The merely personal, he thought, in a burst of contempt. People killed each other for reasons that were merely personal. Deep Star 3, checklist options. Descend, ascend, secure, shut down, monitor, cancel. Norman pressed ascend. The screen changed to the drawing of the instrument panel with the flashing point. He waited for the next instruction. Yes, he thought, it was true. Scientists refused to deal with the irrational. But the irrational side didn't go away if you refused to deal with it. Irrationality didn't atrophy with disuse. On the contrary, left unattended, the irrational side of man had grown in power and scope. And complaining about it didn't help either. All those scientists whining in the Sunday supplements about man's inherent destructiveness and his propensity for violence, throwing up their hands, that wasn't dealing with the irrational side. That was just a formal admission that they were giving up on it. The screen changed again. Deep Star 3. Ascend checklist. 1. Set ballast blowers to on. Proceed to next. Cancel. Norman pushed buttons on the panel, setting the ballast blowers, and waited for the next screen. After all, how did scientists approach their own research? The scientists all agreed, scientific research can't be stopped. If we don't build the bomb, someone else will. But then, pretty soon, the bomb was in the hands of new people, who said, if we don't use the bomb, someone else will. At which point, the scientists said, Those other people are terrible people. They're irrational and irresponsible. We scientists are okay, but those other people are a real problem. Yet the truth was that responsibility began with each individual person and the choices he made. Each person had a choice. Well, Norman thought, there was nothing he could do for Harry or Beth any longer. He had to save himself. He heard a deep hum as the generators turned on and the throb of the propellers. The screen flashed. Deep Star 3, pilot instruments activated. Here we go, he thought, resting his hands confidently on the controls. He felt the submarine respond beneath him. Your attention, please. 17 minutes and counting. Muddy sediment churned up around the canopy as the screws engaged, and then the little submarine slipped out from beneath the dome. It was just like driving a car, he thought. There was nothing to it. He turned in a slow arc, away from DH-7, toward DH-8. He was 20 feet above the bottom, high enough for the screws to clear the mud. There were 17 minutes left. At a maximum ascent rate of 6.6 feet per second, he did the mental calculation quickly, effortlessly, he would reach the surface in 2.5 minutes. There was plenty of time. He moved the submarine close to DH-8. The exterior habitat floodlights were yellow and pale. Power must be dropping. He could see the damage to the cylinders, streams of bubbles rising from the weakened A and B cylinders, the dents in the D, and the gaping hole in E-sill, which was flooded. The habitat was battered and dying. Why had he come so close? He squinted at the portholes, then realized he was hoping to catch sight of Harry and Beth one last time. He wanted to see Harry, unconscious and unresponsive. He wanted to see Beth standing at the window, shaking her fist at him in maniacal rage. He wanted confirmation that he was right to leave them. But he saw only the fading yellow light inside the habitat. He was disappointed. Norman. Yes, Beth. He felt comfortable answering her now. He had his hands on the controls of the submarine, ready to make his ascent. There was nothing she could do to him now. Norman, you really are a son of a bitch. You tried to kill me, Beth. I didn't want to kill you. I had no choice, Norman. Yeah, well, me too. I have no choice. As he spoke, he knew he was right. Better for one person to survive. Better than nothing. You're just going to leave us? That's right, Beth. His hand moved to the ascent rate dial. He set it to 6.6 feet, ready to ascend. You're just going to run away? He heard the contempt in her voice. That's right, Beth. You, the one who kept talking about how we had to stay together down here? Sorry, Beth. You must be very afraid, Norman. I'm not afraid at all. And indeed he felt strong and confident, setting the controls, preparing for his ascent. He felt better than he had felt for days. Norman, she said, please help us. Please! Her words struck him at some deep level, arousing feelings of caring, of professional competence, of simple human kindness. For a moment he felt confusion. His strength and conviction weakened. But then he got a grip on himself and shook his head. The strength flew back into his body. Sorry, Beth. It's too late for that. And he pressed the ascend button, heard the roar as the ballast tanks blew, and Deep Star 3 swayed. The habitat slipped away below him, and he started toward the surface, 1,000 feet above. Black water, no sense of movement except for the readings on the glowing green instrument panel. He began to review the events in his mind as if he were already facing a Navy inquiry. Had he done the right thing, leaving the others behind? Unquestionably, he had. The sphere was an alien object which gave a person the power to manifest his thoughts. Well and good, except that human beings had a split in their brains, a split in their mental processes. It was almost as if men had two brains. The conscious brain could be consciously controlled and presented no problem, but the unconscious brain, wild and abandoned, was dangerous and destructive when its impulses were manifested. The trouble with people like Harry and Beth was that they were literally unbalanced. Their conscious brains were overdeveloped, but they had never bothered to explore their unconscious. That was the difference between Norman and them. As a psychologist, Norman had some acquaintance with his unconscious. It held no surprises for him. That was why Harry and Beth had manifested monsters, but Norman had not. Norman knew his unconscious. No monsters awaited him.
No. Wrong. He was startled by the suddenness of the thought, the abruptness of it. Was he really wrong? He considered carefully, and decided once again that he was correct after all. Beth and Harry were at risk from the products of their unconscious, but Norman was not. Norman knew himself. The others did not. The fears unleashed by contact with the new life form are not understood. The most likely consequence of contact is absolute terror. The statements from his own report popped into his head. Why should he think of them now? It had been years since he had written his report. Under circumstances of extreme terror, people make decisions poorly. Yet Norman wasn't afraid, far from it. He was confident and strong. He had a plan. He was carrying it out. Why should he even think of that report? At the time, he'd agonized over it, thinking of each sentence. Why was it coming to mind now? It troubled him. Your attention, please. 16 minutes and counting. Norman scanned the gauges before him. He was at 900 feet, rising swiftly. There was no turning back now. Why should he even think of turning back? Why should it enter his mind? As he rose silently through black water, he increasingly felt a kind of split inside himself, an almost schizophrenic internal division. Something was wrong, he sensed. There was something he hadn't considered yet. But what could he have overlooked? Nothing, he decided, because unlike Beth and Harry, I am fully conscious. I am aware of everything that is happening inside me. Except Norman didn't really believe that. Complete awareness might be a philosophical goal, but it was not really attainable. Consciousness was like a pebble that rippled the surface of the unconscious. As consciousness widened, there was still more unconsciousness beyond. There was always more, just beyond reach. Even for a humanistic psychologist. Stein, his old professor. You always have your shadow. What was Norman's shadow side doing now? What was happening in the unconscious, denied parts of his own brain? Nothing. Keep going up. He shifted uneasily in the pilot's chair. He wanted to go to the surface so badly. He felt such conviction. I hate Beth. I hate Harry. I hate worrying about these people, caring for them. I don't want to care anymore. It's not my responsibility. I want to save myself. I hate them. I hate them. He was shocked. Shocked by his own thoughts, the vehemence of them. I must go back, he thought. If I go back, I will die. But some other part of himself was growing stronger with each moment. What Beth had said was true. Norman had been the one who kept saying that they had to stay together, to work together. How could he abandon them now? He couldn't. It was against everything he believed in. Everything that was important and human. He had to go back. I am afraid to go back. At last, he thought, there it is. Fear so strong he had denied its existence. Fear that had caused him to rationalize abandoning the others. He pressed the controls, halting his ascent. As he started back down, he saw that his hands were shaking. 01:30 hours. The sub came to rest gently on the bottom, beside the habitat. Norman stepped into the submarine airlock, flooded the chamber. Moments later, he climbed down the side and walked toward the habitat. The TVAC explosives cones, with their blinking red lights, looked oddly festive. Your attention, please. 14 minutes and counting. He estimated the time he would need. 1 minute to get inside. 5, maybe 6 minutes to dress Beth and Harry in the suits. Another 4 minutes to reach the sub and get them aboard. 2 or 3 minutes to make the ascent. It was going to be close. He moved beneath the big support pylons under the habitat. So you came back, Norman. Beth said over the intercom. Yes, Beth. Thank God, she said. She started to cry. He was beneath A-sill, hearing her sobs over the intercom. He found the hatch cover, spun the wheel to open it. It was locked shut. Beth,
Open the hatch. She was crying over the intercom. She didn't answer him. Beth, can you hear me? Open the hatch. Crying like a child, sobbing hysterically. Norman, she said, please help me, please. I'm trying to help you, Beth. Open the hatch.
I can't.
What do you mean you can't?
It won't do any good.
Beth, he said, come on now.
I can't do it, Norman.
Of course you can. Open the hatch, Beth.
You shouldn't have come back, Norman.
There was no time for this now. Beth, pull yourself together. Open the hatch.
No, Norman, I can't.
And she began crying again. He tried all the hatches, one after another. B-sill, locked. C-sill, locked. D-sill, locked. Your attention, please. 13 minutes and counting. He was standing by E-sill, which had been flooded in an earlier attack. He saw the gaping, jagged tear in the outer cylinder surface. The hole was large enough for him to climb through, but the edges were sharp, and if he tore his suit... No, he decided, it was too risky. He moved beneath E-sill. Was there a hatch? He found the hatch, spun the wheel. It opened easily. He pushed the circular lid upward, heard it clang against the inner wall.
Norman, is that you?
He hauled himself up, into E-sill. He was panting from the exertion, on his hands and knees on the deck of E-sill. He shut the hatch and locked it again, then took a moment to get his breath. Your attention, please. 12 minutes and counting. Jesus, he thought. Already? Something white drifted past his faceplate, startling him. He pulled back, realized it was a box of cornflakes. When he touched it, the cardboard disintegrated in his hands, the flakes like yellow snow. He was in the kitchen. Beyond the stove, he saw another hatch leading to D-sill. D-sill was not flooded, which meant that he must somehow pressurize E-sill. He looked up, saw an overhead bulkhead hatch leading to the living room with the gaping tear. He climbed up quickly. He needed to find gas, some kind of tanks. The living room was dark, except for the reflected light from the floodlights, which filtered in through the tear. Cushions and padding floated in the water. Something touched him, and he spun and saw dark hair streaming around a face. And as the hair moved, he saw part of the face was missing, torn away grotesquely. Tina. Norman shuddered, pushed her body away. It drifted off, moving upward. Your attention, please. 11 minutes and counting. It was all happening too fast, he thought. There was hardly enough time left. He needed to be inside the habitat now. No tanks in the living room. He climbed back down to the kitchen, shutting the hatch above. He looked at the stove, the ovens. He opened the oven door, and a burst of gas bubbled out, air trapped in the oven. But that couldn't be right, he thought, because gas was still coming out. A trickle of bubbles continued to come from the open oven. A steady trickle. What had Barnes said about cooking under pressure? There was something unusual about it. He couldn't remember exactly. Did they use gas? Yes, but they also needed more oxygen. That meant... He pulled the stove away from the wall, grunting with exertion, and then he found it. A squat bottle of propane and two large blue tanks. Oxygen tanks. He twisted the Y-valves, his gloved fingers clumsy. Gas began to roar out. The bubbles rushed up to the ceiling, where the gas was trapped, the big air bubble that was forming. He opened the second oxygen tank. The water level fell rapidly to his waist, then his knees. Then it stopped. The tanks must be empty. No matter, the level was low enough. Your attention, please. 10 minutes and counting. Norman opened the bulkhead door to D-sill and stepped through into the habitat. The light was dim. A strange green, slimy mold covered the walls. On the couch, Harry lay unconscious, the intravenous line still in his arm. Norman pulled the needle out with a spurt of blood. He shook Harry, trying to rouse him. Harry's eyelids fluttered, but he was otherwise unresponsive. Norman lifted him, put him over his shoulder, carried him through the habitat. On the intercom, Beth was still crying, Norman, you shouldn't have come. Where are you, Beth? On the monitors, he read, Detonation sequence 0932. Counting backward, the numbers seemed to move too fast. Take Harry and go, Norman. Both of you go. Leave me behind. Tell me where you are, Beth. He was moving through the habitat from D to C-sill. He didn't see her anywhere. Harry was a dead weight on his shoulder, making it difficult to get through the bulkhead doors.
It won't do any good, Norman.
Come on, Beth.
I know I'm bad, Norman. I know I can't be helped.
Beth. He was hearing her through the helmet radio, so he could not locate her by the sound, but he could not risk removing his helmet. Not now.
I deserve to die, Norman.
Cut it out, Beth.
Attention, please. 9 minutes and counting.
A new alarm sounded, an intermittent beeping that became louder and more intense as the seconds ticked by. He was in B-Sill, a maze of pipes and equipment. Once clean and multicolored, now the slimy mold coated every surface. In some places, fibrous, mossy strands hung down. B-Sill looked like a jungle swamp. Beth. She was silent now. She must be in this room, he thought. B-Sill had always been Beth's favorite place, the place where the habitat was controlled. He put Harry on the deck, propped him against a wall. But the wall was slippery, and Harry slid down, banged his head. He coughed, opened his eyes. Jesus. Norman? Norman held his hand up, signaling Harry to be quiet. Beth? Norman said. No answer. Norman moved among the slimy pipes. Beth?
Leave me, Norman.
I can't do that, Beth. I'm taking you, too.
No, I'm staying, Norman.
Beth, he said, there's no time for this.
I'm staying, Norman. I deserve to stay.
He saw her. Beth was huddled in the back, wedged among pipes, crying like a child. She held one of the explosive-tipped spear guns in her hand. She looked at him tearfully.
Oh, Norman, she said, you were going to leave us.
I'm sorry. I was wrong. He started toward her, holding out his hands to her. She swung the spear gun around.
No, you were right. You were right. I want you to leave now.
Above her head, he saw a glowing monitor, the numbers clicking inexorably backward. 0827, 0826. He thought, I can change this. I want the numbers to stop counting. The numbers did not stop.
You can't fight me, Norman, she said, huddled in the corner. Her eyes blazed with furious energy.
I can see that.
There isn't much time, Norman. I want you to leave.
She held the gun, pointed firmly toward him. He had a sudden sense of the absurdity of it all, that he had come back to rescue someone who didn't want to be rescued. What could he do now? Beth was wedged back in there, beyond his reach, beyond his help. There was barely enough time for him to get away, let alone to take Harry. Harry, he thought suddenly. Where was Harry now? I want Harry to help me. But he wondered if there was time. The numbers were clicking backward. There was hardly more than 8 minutes now. I came back for you, Beth.
Go, she said. Go now, Norman.
But Beth...
No, Norman, I mean it. Go. Why don't you go?
And then she began to get suspicious. She started to look around, and at that moment Harry stood up behind her and swung the big wrench down on her head, and there was a sickening thud, and she fell.
Did I kill her?
Harry said. And the deep male voice said, Attention, please. 8 minutes and counting. Norman concentrated on the clock as it ticked backwards. Stop. Stop the countdown. But when he looked again, the clock was still ticking backwards. And the alarm. Was the alarm interfering with his concentration? He tried again. Stop now. The countdown will stop now. The countdown has stopped.
Forget it, Harry said. It won't work.
But it should work. Norman said.
Nope, Harry said, because she's not completely unconscious.
On the floor at their feet, Beth groaned. Her leg moved. She's still able to control it somehow, Norman said. She's very strong.
Can we inject her?
Norman shook his head. There was no time to go back for the syringe. Anyway, if they injected her and it didn't work, it would be time wasted.
Hit her again?
Harry said.
Harder? Kill her?
No, Norman said.
Killing her is the only way...
No, Norman said, thinking, we didn't kill you, Harry, when we had the chance.
If you won't kill her, then you can't do anything about that timer,
Harry said, so we better get the hell out. They ran for the airlock.
How much time is left?
Harry said. They were in the A-Sill airlock, trying to put the suit on Beth. She was groaning. Blood was matted on the back of her head. Beth struggled a little, making it more difficult.
Jesus, Beth! How much time, Norman?
7.5 minutes, maybe less. Her legs were in. They quickly pushed her arms in, zipped up the chest. They turned on her air. Norman helped Harry with his suit.
Attention, please. 7 minutes and counting.
Harry said, how much time you figure to get to the surface?
2.5 minutes after we get inside the sub, Norman said.
Great,
Harry said. Norman snapped Harry's helmet locked.
Let's go.
Harry descended into the water, and Norman lowered Beth's unconscious body. She was heavy with the tank and weights.
Come on, Norman.
Norman plunged into the water.
At the submarine, Norman climbed up to the hatch entrance, but the untethered sub rolled unpredictably with his weight. Harry, standing on the bottom, tried to push Beth up toward Norman, but Beth kept bending over at the waist. Norman, grabbing for her, fell off the sub and slid to the bottom.
Attention, please. 6 minutes and counting.
Hurry, Norman. 6 minutes.
I heard, damn it. Norman got to his feet, climbed back on the sub, but now his suit was muddy, his gloves slippery. Harry was counting.
529, 528, 527.
Norman caught Beth's arm, but she slipped away again.
Damn it, Norman, hold on to her.
I'm trying.
Here she is again.
Attention, please. 5 minutes and counting.
The alarm was now high-pitched, beeping insistently. They had to shout over it to be heard.
Harry, give her to me. Well, here, take her.
Missed.
Here.
Norman finally caught Beth's air hose in his hand, just behind the helmet. He wondered if it would pull out, but he had to risk it. Gripping the hose, he hauled Beth up until she lay on her back on the top of the sub. Then he eased her down into the hatch.
429, 428.
Norman had trouble keeping his balance. He got one of Beth's legs into the hatch, but the other knee was bent, jammed against the lip of the hatch. He couldn't get her down. Every time he leaned forward to unbend her leg, the whole submarine tipped and he would start to lose his balance again.
416, 415.
Would you stop counting and do something?
Harry pressed his body against the side of the submarine, countering the rolling with his weight. Norman leaned forward and pressed Beth's knee straight. She slid easily into the open hatch. Norman climbed in after her. It was a one-man airlock, but Beth was unconscious and could not work the controls. He would have to do it for her.
Attention, please. 4 minutes and counting.
He was cramped in the airlock, his body pressed up against Beth, chest to chest, her helmet banging against his. With difficulty, he pulled the hatch closed over his head. He blew out the water in a furious rush of compressed air. Unsupported by the water, Beth's body now sagged heavily against him. He reached around her for the handle to the inner hatch. Beth's body blocked his way. He tried to twist her around sideways. In the confined space, he couldn't get any leverage on the body. Beth was like a dead weight. He tried to shift her body around to get to the hatch. The whole submarine began to sway. Harry was climbing up the side.
What the hell's going on in there?
Harry, will you shut up?
Well, what's the delay?
Norman's hand closed on the inner latch handle. He shoved it down, but the door didn't move. The door was hinged to swing inward. He couldn't open it with Beth in the hatch with him. It was too crowded. Her body blocked the movement of the door.
Harry, we've got a problem.
Jesus Christ, 3:30.
Norman began to sweat. They were really in trouble now.
Harry, I've got to pass her out to you and go in alone.
Jesus, Norman!
Norman flooded the airlock, opened the upper hatch once again. Harry's balance atop the submarine was precarious. He grabbed Beth by the air hose, dragged her up. Norman reached up to close the hatch.
Harry, can you get her feet out of the way?
I'm trying to keep my balance here.
Can't you see her feet are blocking?
Irritably, Norman pushed Beth's feet aside. The hatch clanged down. The air blasted past him. The hatch pressurized.
Attention, please. 2 minutes and counting.
He was inside the submarine. The instruments glowed green. He opened the inner hatch.
Norman?
Try and get her down, Norman said. Do it as fast as you can.
But he was thinking they were in terrible trouble. At least 30 seconds to get Beth into the hatch, and 30 seconds more for Harry to come down. A minute altogether.
She's in. Vent it.
Norman jumped for the air vent, blew out the water.
How'd you get her in so fast, Harry?
Nature's way, Harry said, to get people through tight spaces.
And before Norman could ask what that meant, he had opened the hatch and saw that Harry had pushed Beth into the airlock head first. He grabbed her shoulders and eased her onto the floor of the submarine, then slammed the hatch shut. Moments later, he heard the blast of air as Harry, too, vented the airlock. The submarine hatch clanged.
Harry came forward.
Christ, 1:40, Harry said. Do you know how to work this thing?
Yes. Norman sat in the seat, placed his hands on the controls. They heard the whine of the props, felt the rumble. The sub lurched, moved off the bottom. 1:30. How long did you say to the surface? 2:30, Norman said, cranking up the ascent rate. He pushed it past 6.6 to the far end of the dial. They heard a high-pitched shriek of air as the ballast tanks blew. The sub nosed up sharply, began to rise swiftly.
Is this as fast as it goes?
Yes.
Jesus!
Take it easy, Harry. Looking back down, they could see the habitat with its lights, and then the long lines of explosives set over the spaceship itself. They rose past the high fin of the spacecraft, leaving it behind, seeing only black water now.
1:20.
900 feet, Norman said. There was very little sensation of movement, only the changing dials on the instrument panel to tell them they were moving.
It's not fast enough, Harry said. That's a hell of a lot of explosive down there.
It is fast enough, Norman thought, correcting him.
The shock wave will crush us like a can of sardines, Harry said, shaking his head.
The shock wave will not harm us.
800 feet.
40 seconds, Harry said. We'll never make it.
We'll make it. They were at 700 feet, rising fast. The water now had a faint blue color, sunlight filtering down.
30 seconds, Harry said. Where are we? 29? 8?
620 feet, Norman said. 610. They looked back down the side of the sub. They could barely discern the habitat, faint pinpricks of light far beneath them. Beth coughed.
It's too late now, Harry said. I knew from the beginning we'd never make it.
Yes, we will, Norman said.
10 seconds, Harry said. 9? 8? Brace yourself!
Norman pulled Beth to his chest as the explosion rocked the submarine, spinning it like a toy, upending it, then righting them again, and lifting them in a giant upward surge.
Mama!
Harry shouted, but they were still rising. They were okay.
We did it!
200 feet, Norman said. The water outside was now light blue. He pushed buttons, slowing the ascent. They were going up very fast. Harry was screaming, pounding Norman on the back.
We did it! God damn it, you son of a bitch! We did it! We survived! I never thought we would! We survived!
Norman was having trouble seeing the instruments for tears in his eyes. And then he had to squint as bright sunlight streamed into the bubble canopy as they surfaced, and they saw calm seas, sky, and fluffy clouds.
Do you see that?
Harry cried. He was screaming in Norman's ear.
Do you see that? It is a perfect goddamned day.
0000 hours. Norman awoke to see a brilliant shaft of light streaming through the single porthole, shining down on the chemical toilet in the corner of the decompression chamber. He lay on his bunk and looked around the chamber. A horizontal cylinder, 50 feet long. Bunks, a metal table and chairs in the center of the cylinder, toilet behind a small partition. Harry snored in the bunk above him. Across the chamber, Beth slept, one arm flung over her face. Faintly, from a distance, he heard men shouting. Norman yawned and swung off the bunk. His body was sore, but he was otherwise all right. He walked to the shining porthole and looked out, squinting in the bright Pacific sun. He saw the rear deck of the research ship John Hawes, the white helicopter pad, heavy coiled cables, the tubular metal frame of an underwater robot. The Navy crew was lowering a second robot over the side with a lot of shouting and swearing and waving of hands. Norman had heard their voices faintly through the thick steel walls of the chamber. Near the chamber itself, a muscular seaman rolled a large green tank marked Oxygen alongside a dozen other tanks on the deck. The three-man medical crew, which supervised the decompression chamber, played cards. Looking through the inch-thick glass of the porthole, Norman felt as if he were peering into a miniature world to which he had little connection, a kind of terrarium populated by interesting and exotic specimens.
This new world was as alien to him as the dark ocean world had once seemed from inside the habitat. He watched the crew slap down their cards on a wooden packing crate, watched them laugh and gesture as the game proceeded. They never glanced in his direction, never looked at the decompression chamber. Norman didn't understand these young men. Were they supposed to be paying attention to the decompression? They looked young and inexperienced to Norman. Focused on their card game, they seemed indifferent to the huge metal chamber nearby, indifferent to the three survivors inside the chamber, and indifferent to the larger meaning of the mission, to the news the survivors had brought back to the surface. These cheerful Navy card players didn't seem to give a damn about Norman's mission. But perhaps they didn't know. He turned back to the chamber, sat down at the table. His knee throbbed, and the skin was swollen around the white bandage. He had been treated by a Navy physician during their transfer from the submarine to the decompression chamber. He had been taken off the Minisub Deep Star 3 in a pressurized diving bell, and from there had been transferred to the large chamber on the deck of the ship. The SDC, the Navy called it, the surface decompression chamber. They were going to spend 4 days here. Norman wasn't sure how long he had been here so far. They had all immediately gone to sleep, and there was no clock in the chamber. The face of his own wristwatch was smashed, although he didn't remember it happening. On the table in front of him, someone had scratched USN sucks into the surface. Norman ran his fingers over the grooves and remembered the grooves in the silver sphere. But he and Harry and Beth were in the hands of the Navy now. And he thought, what are we going to tell them? What are we going to tell them? Beth said. It was several hours later. Beth and Harry had awakened, and now they were all sitting around the scarred metal table. None of them had made any attempt to talk to the crew outside. It was, Norman thought, as if they shared an unspoken agreement to remain in isolation a while longer. I think we'll have to tell them everything, Harry said. I don't think we should, Norman said. He was surprised by the strength of his conviction, the firmness of his own voice. I agree, Beth said. I'm not sure the world is ready for that sphere. I certainly wasn't. She gave Norman a sheepish look. He put his hand on her shoulder. That's fine, Harry said. But look at it from the standpoint of the Navy. The Navy has mounted a large and expensive operation. 5 people have died, and 2 habitats have been destroyed. They're going to want answers, and they're going to keep asking until they get them. We can refuse to talk, Beth said. That won't make any difference, Harry said. Remember, the Navy has all the tapes. That's right, the tapes, Norman said. He had forgotten about the videotapes they had brought up in the submarine. Dozens of tapes, documenting everything that had happened in the habitat during their time underwater. Documenting the squid, the deaths, the sphere, documenting everything. End of Side 8. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.